Thank you. Thank you, Duncan, a lawyer for my sins. Can I say also what a privilege it is to be here with Michael and Richard? I did a similar kind of interview format with Michael when he was then the chief executive of Wesfarmers, and Trevor Eastwood, who was the former chief executive of Wesfarmers. We did that about 6 or 7 years ago, and of course back then Michael was the young bull and Trevor was the old bull. And well, I'm very sorry, Michael, you're now the old bull and Richard, you're the young bull. And it was about the same time also my wife described Michael as the thinking woman's Brad Pitt. And I asked her this week, Michael, whether you still qualified. And she says you do. You're still the thinking woman's Brad Pitt. So I said to my wife, well, how would you describe Richard? And she thought for a moment and she said, he's that poor bugger who bought Coles just before the markets collapsed. Sorry, Richard, I'll work on it. I'm sure we can come up with something better than that. But let's start, if you don't mind, with the Great Recession. It's been called all sorts of things, the global financial crisis, the global economic crisis, the Prime Minister calls it a shitstorm. What do you call it and how are you managing?
Well, Tom, I think it's a pretty serious recession. Whether it's the Great Recession and whether it's going to be worse than anything since the 30s remains to be seen. And, you know, if you ask 20 economists and 20 business leaders around the world when this will end and how deep it'll be, you'll get 40 different opinions. I must say, it seems to me it ought to be as big, it ought to be bigger than any other recession we've had since the 1930s for two reasons. Firstly, the great destruction of wealth that's occurred around the world that causes everybody to be cautious and keep their hands in their pockets. And secondly, because of the dislocation there's been in the financial system, and you know, we still have a very, very fragile international financial system, and until that's cured, you'd expect that economic activity would be badly affected. The curious thing is that if you had a worse recession this year than 1991, 1982 and so on, you'd expect, in the case of banks, bad debts to be a lot higher than they were in those recessions. And if you go and talk to any bank today, you'll find they're currently budgeting on bad debts in the next year and the year after being considerably lower than they were, for example, in 1982. Now, interest rates are lower and that helps, but it may be that the banks just haven't yet seen the worst of it and we've got a lot more negative surprises coming up ahead. Time will tell, but at this stage, at least from that point of view, it doesn't look as bad as some of those other recessions. And of course we all hope that's the case, and we hope that, as in when Asia collapsed in the late 90s and the world went into recession in 01, Australia comes through much more gently and that we do come out of this later in the year.
Richard, do you share Michael's view on that?
Yeah, well firstly, Tom, thanks for having me. I'm pretty certain that your wife will describe us in the future as that company who bought Coles and made a lot of value for shareholders over time.
I hope you're right.
And I'm very confident on that. Secondly, I'm not sure it matters what acronym you use for the global financial crisis. I think it's a whole lot better having GFC rather than FFC. As Mike said, it certainly has been serious. I've just come back from doing an investor trip in London and New York and Singapore and Hong Kong, and I must say I described it to some people there as in my country days, driving along where you look in the rear vision mirror and there's blue sky, and that's where we've been, I think. And in some ways that's where some of our businesses are at the moment. And then you look ahead and there's a storm, and you know you've got to drive through the storm to get home. And you're not sure whether you'll just get wet or whether it's going to be a bit more rugged going through the storm. And clearly around the world it's been rugged. I agree with Mike, I think the Australian economy is somewhat better placed because of a number of reasons, the health of our financial institutions and a few other things. But it's obviously been serious. And it's been really challenging running a company in this environment because things have changed so dramatically and so quickly. It's been difficult to stay ahead of the game. So obviously it's challenging times, although I think we're in relatively good shape.
When you do your sensitivities analysis, and all good companies do them, did you ever anticipate a scenario like this, though?
Well, if I think about the bank, for example, the bank does stress testing and sensitivity analysis all the time. And it's fair to say that no one anticipated the ructions in the world financial system that we're seeing today. The result of that has been that banks found themselves short of capital when it actually did happen, whereas the capital is supposed to be a buffer against these circumstances. And that's why we've had so many capital raisings and in other countries, government injecting funds into the banks. In that sense, it's useful experience because the models that are used going forward will take account of this disruption and you know, it lessens the chance of it happening again. But I must say, the lesson from it is, I think, that the past is not the key to the future. The future is impossible to predict, and it may well contain things that are much worse or much better than what you've seen in the past.
Before I kind of move off this issue of the GFC, I guess it's related at the moment, executive salaries. Should boards be taking a different approach to remuneration in the GFC environment?
Well, do you want me to go first? And we've probably got different opinions.
I can't wait. He might not be too happy about what you're about to say.
Yeah, I mean, inevitably boards will take a different approach, and we've been in the companies I'm involved with thinking about whether we should be on the front foot and proactively anticipating what will come out of the various discussions going on between governments around the world. My view is it's better actually to be a follower in this because you can go off half-cocked and end up having to change everything again. But, you know, everyone knows there's widespread community discomfort with not only people being paid a lot of money where the companies have done badly, but I think the level of executive salaries, that's been a case for the last 10 years, really, where people have felt, gee, there's very large salaries being paid to executives and modest salaries being paid to most people in the community. And it may be that we'll see a bit of a sea change here. Certainly.
Did you think that got out of whack?
Well, I think to a large extent they did. You know, there wasn't much objection generally where companies had done really well and people were rewarded. But we all have an objection where companies have done really badly and people still seem to get rewarded well. Wayne Swan made the comment the other day that the main or one of the main agenda items at the next G20 meeting is executive salaries, which seems incredible if that's right. But it, I think, illustrates how seriously people are taking the issue. And as we saw yesterday, we can expect to see some actions being taken by governments as a result.
I'll come back to you in a second, Michael, and see whether you're comfortable with government intervention. Richard, what's your view on executive remuneration?
I'll give some general comments, Tom. Firstly, I don't think it's as simple as looking at public company executives because remuneration extends across a lot of sectors. And it's because of transparency in public companies, which is a great value, particularly in the environment we're currently in, but that it's public company executives that are under the spotlight. But if you look at employment per se, then I hope the Productivity Commission work in this will look at all of that because you can't just deal with executive compensation in public companies and expect the problem to be solved. All you'll get is a shift to the private sector, private companies, to private equity, to the law or investment banking where salaries aren't transparent. So I think you've got to take into account the market. And one thing we've got to be very careful in this debate is that it's kept rational and sensible. And that we don't damage business as a consequence of things that are done to react to short-term political issues.
The government's moved on golden handshakes. Are you comfortable with that government intervention? And would you have a problem if there was a binding vote on executive salaries?
Well, firstly, I think the Productivity Commission review is a good thing, much better than shooting from the hip. On the golden handshakes, we haven't seen much detail, but it's fraught with difficulty in the detail, I think. For example, I read something this morning that inferred that accrued long service leave or annual leave would be included in that 1 year's base salary amount, which seems unfair in a case where somebody has that, somebody else has taken all their leave. But, you know, I think in the end, for single decisions like that, discrete decisions, going to the shareholders is a reasonable thing to do. After all, they own the company. On the other hand, having binding shareholder votes on remuneration packages and so on, or remuneration reports, is crazy, as our Federal Minister for Finance said, because if the shareholders knock back the remuneration report in a binding way, who's going to then negotiate, renegotiate the terms with the executives? Shareholders put their faith in the directors to do those things, and I think it's a matter of having proper rules about and proper governance about performance-based pay, proper vesting, no vesting if you don't do well, and so on. And the fact is, Australian remuneration practices have been way ahead of those in the US in particular in recent years. So in the case of the NAB, for example, we've reported remuneration of over $200 million for people who will never receive any of what was reported because the securities won't vest, because the company hasn't done relatively well enough. And we can't even bring it back through the P&L, by the way. It's gone when it comes back through reserves. But I think I'm looking this year at putting in a note in the remuneration report that tries to illustrate what people were reported as earning and what they actually earned, which is maybe half as much.
Richard, would you feel comfortable about a binding vote from shareholders?
Tom, I agree.
Probably not.
I agree with Mark. Firstly, on termination benefits, I think now most companies in Australia have moved to deal with that. So you're always going to have residual contracts in place, but most contracts tend now to have, certainly mine has, a 12-month termination clause for me and the company, and that's it. And I think that's pretty well standard practice now. And I completely agree with Mike on remuneration votes. I think boards are elected for a reason, and I don't think they should be, those sort of things should be binding at a shareholder vote level. If shareholders have a big enough concern, they can change the board.
What about where there's been significant government assistance, like in Pacific Brands? I mean, is there an opportunity there for more of a say in how executive salaries are and bonuses terminate?
Mike might want to comment. Firstly, unfortunately, this is such an emotive issue, and I think a lot of the reporting on the salary of the CEO of Pacific Brands was emotive and irrational and not as clear as it should have been, because she was promoted into the role, and that's why her salary has increased. And people seem to have forgotten that. It follows that when I succeeded Mike, my salary went up as you take on a bigger job, and that certainly happened in the case of Pacific Brands.
But what about the principle, Richard, where there is a lot of government assistance in a business?
Then I think that's part of a discussion government can have with business at the time and with the board at the time. If you're putting your hands out for taxpayer assistance, then I think everything's on the table to be discussed.
You agree with that, Mike?
Well, I think so. I think, for example, where a government nationalises a bank and ends up owning 90% of it, as has happened in the UK, you'd expect them to exert real control over the remuneration in there. In other cases, in the case of Pacific Brands, that assistance was granted over many years, along with assistance to other manufacturing industries. And to then link, as Richard said, the increase in salary when someone's promoted to CEO with that is just irrational.
The other big topic at the moment is foreign investment in Australia, particularly Chinese investment, state government, Chinese government investment in Australia. Are you taking advantage of these cheap investment opportunities in Australia at this desperate times when Australian companies are needing cash? Are you comfortable with that? How do you feel about that?
Well, perhaps as a general comment, Australia needs to attract foreign capital. We have a massive current account deficit and massive national external debt. And we rely on capital coming in from foreigners to keep our economy going. And so the last thing we should be doing is discouraging people from investing in Australia. Having said that, there are circumstances where it may be deemed to be against the national interest for somebody to have control or significant influence. And the case of Shell having a go at Woodside some years ago was one where the Treasurer decided that was an example of that. There's a fair bit of reporting on the Rio case at the moment, and I'm not close to that, and I hesitate to discuss that in any detail, but I think the important thing is to ensure that the funds that are important to the company in retiring debt come in a way that doesn't give a government, a foreign government, or major customers control to the extent, or influence to the extent, that Australian residents are disadvantaged. And I think that's the test. From what I've seen of it, there's a fair bit of influence and control envisaged in that, and maybe with some changes to the conditions that can be approved.
So it would have been better off having a rights issue rather than a placement?
Well, I don't know about that. There are pros and cons on both sides. I mean, if you looked at the Wesfarmers case recently, I think you'd conclude that might have been a very good alternative.
Richard, foreign investment?
Tom, I guess if I looked through this one through the CEO's eyes, as a company, if you're carrying some debt and you need to deal with debt and you've got some options, you can sell assets, you can raise new equity, or you can sell a position in the company. And the things you've got to take into account are, what value do you get if you sell assets, what will be the implication of the rights issue in terms of dilution, and then what control are you ceding if you give away, if you sell parts of your company. And those are the things that I'd be looking at. I think it's undoubtedly more complex running businesses when you're not 100% owner. So that would weigh heavily on me. But if I was CEO of a company that was listed in the UK, I'd also be concerned about the capacity to underwrite any equity issue because of the particular rules that apply in the UK. So it's a difficult one. I completely agree with Mike on the importance of offshore investment. I would be thinking about, is it going to complicate running the company, and what's the likelihood of success through some sort of rights issue? One of the interesting things we found in the rights issue recently at Wesfarmers is, firstly, shareholders appreciated having the opportunity. Secondly, the more it looked like the retail component of our rights issue, which wasn't underwritten, would be successful, in brackets, the more we were diluting earnings per share and return on equity, the more our share price went up, because the more confidence people had in the balance sheet strength of the company. So we're in extraordinary times at the moment.
Can I come back just quickly to the point about, do you guys have an issue with foreign government per se, government investment, or your responses would be the same?
I think that'd be the same,
yeah. Can I move on now to chairman and CEO related issues specifically? How does a chair and his CEO interact on strategy development?
Well, Tom, I've always believed that strategy is something to be developed by management and reviewed by the board. I've sat on a number of boards, I must say, where directors, after coming onto the board after a few months or a year or so, say, gee, we want to be more involved in strategy. And at Wesfarmers, I remember one director saying that, and I said to him, well, our strategies are to run the businesses better, expand them as we find opportunities, and manage the portfolio. But if you can think of another one, that'd be great.
What sort of response did you get?
A typical response from management. I just think management is in a much better position to develop a strategy for a company than the board is, because the directors meet, six or seven or eight times a year for a day or two. The management's there 24 hours a day thinking about the issues and discussing it internally. And the important role the board has, I think, is of reviewing the strategies that have emerged and maybe tweaking them, maybe saying, have you thought of this? Isn't the world going to be different because of this or that? And providing that sort of overview input to the management.
What about if there's a conflict? How would a conflict be resolved?
Well, I think we saw a case in Rio a week or two ago where the incoming chairman resolved it by leaving. Mm. And certainly if I were in a position where I had a different view to management and to the rest of the board, I wouldn't stay around if it was a major strategic issue. Because I think you've got to stand on your principles and say, well, I just think it's the wrong direction, and I accept all of you think it's the right direction, so it's better if I move on.
Well, Richard, for you, what happens if you're at odds with your board in terms of a direction you want to go?
Well, it's never happened, Tom. and it hasn't. And I think it is risky if you get into a turf where the board wants to set strategy. I completely agree with Mike, and I've been well-schooled, obviously, but it's the job of management to do it. That's what you're employed to do, and we have to develop and execute strategy, and the board is there to make sure the appropriate governance processes are in place, that performance is monitored, and as Mike said, to certainly make suggestions and tweak. But I think if a board ultimately wants to set strategy and you're going in a different direction as CEO, as Mike said, there's only one way to go. But fortunately, that hasn't happened in any of my experiences. And I think if it did, it'd be a real problem.
Governance purists don't like former chief executives coming back onto the board. Michael, let's start with you. Do you agree with these governance purists?
Yeah, on balance, I do, Tom. Yeah. It does very much depend on the person. You know, there are some individuals who I think could come back on boards and it wouldn't be an issue. And there are obviously some advantages in having somebody who's got a lot of knowledge about the industry or the company sitting there on the board or sitting there as chairman. Trevor Eastwood came back. He said to me when he left, I'll give you 2 years to sort of make your own mark, and then I've agreed with the board, I'll come back. And eventually we talked him into being chairman. It wasn't always plain sailing in that it's inevitable when a chief executive leaves and comes back that whenever an issue comes up where the new CEO is saying, we're going to make this change, there's a feeling of defensiveness that, gee, that sounds a bit like a disapproval of what prevailed or what I put in place. And I'm a very good friend of Trevor's, we get on well, but there were times when I know he felt like that. And I noticed in the book, his biography, which is being released tomorrow or, tomorrow and next week, he comments that when he came back on the board, he felt very frustrated that we weren't going to him and seeking his advice and involving him in things. And that's because we felt things were going well and, we had it all under control. All directors feel a bit like that. I think all NEDs at times. But if you've been CEO, you feel it a bit more. The reason for that, I think, is that when I retired, I felt I missed the old team, the terrific group of people. We had a lot of fun. We sat around and did some good things, and it was very enjoyable. And you miss that afterwards. If you're on the board, it's exacerbated because the same people are still there, and yet they're not asking you to join them. You're sort of an outsider.
Very tough.
And so I think it's better, actually, to make a clean break and leave it to someone else.
Richard, would you have Michael back on your board if you had any say in the matter while you're chief executive?
Well, Tom, I'd have Mike back in a shot because he's an outstanding leader and I think he's got a very clear grasp of the role of a director. But unlike Mike, I wouldn't go back onto the board where I'd been an executive before. I would add that I didn't ever work with Trevor when he was CEO of Wesfarmers, so I joined Wesfarmers in 93 and Mike had already taken over as CEO. And I found having Trevor as my chairman for the first 3.5 years as CEO to be fantastic. Because he knew the company, he'd lived the role of a CEO, he was relatively hands-off and he was a fantastic chairman to have, and I feel very fortunate in this case that I had Trevor, but I would definitely not go on the Wesfarmers board, I think we're a bit the same, you move on and you look for other opportunities and challenges.
Maybe that's the secret, Tom, you wait 2 chief executives and then you can say,
and then you come back
and then you can say, yeah, Richard's changing all those things, that silly bugger changed that I'd
you can change them back. But just to clarify, Bob Every is the chairman of Wesfarmers and there's no hint of him leaving. But I want to make it perfectly clear, if the opportunity presented itself, Michael, you wouldn't go back on the board.
No, maybe ask when there's another CEO.
Next
when I'm
time
78
round.
Or something.
Let's turn now to some Wesfarmers questions. Michael, when you took over from Trevor, there was a lot of expectation around at the time. There were a lot of deals happening and there was this huge expectation. I think Bunnings had just been done and expectation for more deals. And Wesfarmers, the deals didn't come off, always sort of the bridesmaid. And so there was a lot of pressure on you when you took over from someone like Trevor. And similarly, Richard, I mean, you've been under a lot of pressure as well, following on from the footsteps of St. Michael. But also there's been this expectation of people looking for you to put your stamp on Wesfarmers. And I noted the Australian Financial Review suggested recently the ceaseless chatter about matching or bettering Michael may have forced his hand on Coles. Can I ask both of you, how worried were you about the prospect of taking over from successful people? And then how did you find it? How are you finding it then filling those shoes?
Do you want to go first?
Yeah, okay. I felt very well prepared for the role. I'd worked with Mike for 3 years, having come back from Sydney. Some people said to me, why would you want to take over from someone as successful as Michael? My honest view is, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you want to become CEO of a company like Wesfarmers, which is such a great company? Mm. And Michael and Trevor and a whole bunch of others have had a key part in that. And it's the most fantastic job, Tom. It's the best job going. And I love it. And I've never, ever, ever worried about filling the shoes or about the so-called pressure to do things. And I'm completely honest in that. It has never entered my mind about I never worry about what the Richard Goyder legacy at Wesfarmers is. All I want when I leave Wesfarmers is that it's stronger, it's got a strong shareholder focus, it's got a great reputation as a company when I leave it. That's all that matters to me. And I couldn't care less if we're Australia's 50th biggest company or 5th biggest company, whenever that happens, as long as the reputation of the company is intact. And the personal stuff is irrelevant, other than it's a wonderful job working with great people with a whole bunch of really, really interesting, exciting businesses.
Yeah, Tom, I found that an interesting phenomenon because the comment is made in the press when you take over. And I'd worked with Trevor as Richard had with me. I'd worked with him very closely for 8 years and I didn't have any disagreement about his philosophies or what he did. And so my view when I took over was, well, it's business as usual. We'll just carry on with those strategies I mentioned earlier and look for opportunities and so on. And the interesting thing was not only did the press say this, like, when's he going to do something to prove his difference?
Yeah.
Internally, in the organisation, people felt it as well. And I remember when I was preparing for what became our first best practice conference, about 9 months after I'd taken over, I had some consultants go out and talk to the divisional managers about how we might structure the conference. And the idea of it was, let's all get together and talk about what we're doing well so we can replicate that elsewhere and we don't reinvent the wheel and so on. And the consultants came back to me and said, gee, everyone's jumping at shadows and they're saying, is this Mike's way of centralising all control and doing something differently? And I had no intention of doing anything differently. We then had the best practice conference and John Ring, one of our divisional managers, came to me and said, this has really put your stamp on the company. And I was interested in that experience because a year later I read a book, a little pamphlet produced by a headhunting organisation called Taking Charge that described the phenomenon of becoming CEO. And one of the things they described was people expect you to be different and people expect something to happen. And often, a little time after you've taken over, you do something and people say, ah, that's your mark. Now, in Rich's case, maybe it was Coles, not for the purpose of doing that, but because people thought it's something different and this is Richard Goyder. On the more general point about pressure to do something, I used to shake my head and I put it down to Australia having a financial review daily and not enough news to fill it. And they write the same story over and over again. You just keep reading.
They're in the audience, Michael, I think.
Yeah.
They've got something to write tomorrow anyway.
Yeah. Couldn't, you know, can't close a deal, hasn't got vision, too timid, too conservative, all this sort of stuff. And we went for some years without doing a transaction, and then we'd do one and then we might do five because the numbers added up. Mm. And the important message, I think, is for all of those of you who are directors, is that I had the great advantage of a board who were very sensible and who just said, we understand what our philosophy is, we understand why we're not doing this or we are doing that, just carry on. And I've seen other cases where boards react too much to the external comments and end up forcing the CEO to do something silly, and I never had that experience.
Mike, Richard, as your successor, how's he faring? Is he doing all right? It's a tough time to be chief executive of any company, never mind Wesfarmers. How's he going, all right?
He's going really well, I think. Tom's smiling because we were having a chat about this before, and he said that he'll ask me that question, and I said, I'll just say, shithouse, really. but I said, I can't say that because the press will have a headline, Goyder to shithouse, colon, saying I think he's doing a great job, and you'll probably ask me if I would have done the Coles take.
Which was the next question, yeah. Well, you looked at it, didn't you? You looked at it in 2002.
We looked at it back in 2002. Actually, it was just after we'd done Howard Smith, so our hands were full, and we were going to actually get together with Tesco and the warehouse group in New Zealand and do it, and Tesco then pulled out because Safeway came up for sale in the UK, and they couldn't provide the people to look at it, and we were just too flat out to do it ourselves, and so we put it aside. The answer to the question is, I think, probably, there's no way of really knowing because I wasn't in there, and these things are never made by one person, they're made by a team of people, collaboration, you eventually decide we'll do it, and I know that, you know, I know the people concerned, and I know the methods they use to evaluate things haven't changed, and so, you know, the answer's probably.
If you'd been in charge last year, whether you would have bought it, probably.
Yeah.
Richard, some people might say this is a terrible time to be a chief executive of any company, but Wesfarmers, of course, you know, but you're clearly thriving in it. You're loving it. Do you thrive in adversity, or is there so many opportunities with the job? Or?
Well, it's just it's a great job, Tom, and certainly the environment has been more difficult, and that creates a whole lot of challenges. But, you know, Wesfarmers is a very good company with wonderful people and brilliant assets. And we substantially added to those assets a couple of years ago, and we've just got a great opportunity to continue to build all the businesses we've got. We've got a great culture. I remember when Bob Avery, just after Bob joined the board, Tom, he did quite an extensive induction program, and we were talking about something at the board a few months later, Bob came in with a comment. He said, "You know, this company is quite extraordinary." And it's got something quite special, which he picked up in that induction. I think that's right. So it is challenging, but the opportunities in front of us are immense. I won't lie. You know, over the last 6 months, particularly around some of the refinancing issues, there's been challenging times. But you never, as Mike said, you're never dealing with those on your own. You deal with those with a group of highly competent people, and that makes the leadership role much easier, and we've got and have, as long as I've been involved in Wesfarmers, a very supportive board as well. So that's good.
You talk about culture. To what extent in this climate has that famous Wesfarmers return on equity benchmark been a weight around your neck in terms of reputation?
Well, it's a bit like Mike was talking about earlier in terms of acquisitions. At times these things can be seen as a real positive, and other times they can be seen as a negative. And the reality is the return on equity focus is as strong now as it ever has been in my time at Wesfarmers. The return on capital focus of the division is strong. And basically what people are saying at the moment is you've tanked your return on equity. And we've done that. We've bought a low return on equity or return on capital business because we know that we can, with good management, increase the return on capital in that business. And as we do that, we'll improve the group return on equity and total shareholder return.
But have you bent the rules a little bit? Because you've obviously had to give yourself more time to...
No, the rules have always been the same. And I think that's why Mark answered probably to the question before, because our rules of making the investment have been the same. We need to get a positive net present value in the business, we need to exceed our hurdle rates in terms of cash flows in the business. And that's how we've approached everything we've done. Mike and I, in Mike's last year or two as CEO, and in my first year of CEO, so on a 2 or 3 year period, we looked closely at a number of acquisitions, and the vast majority of them were earnings per share accretive. But none of them met our investment hurdles to acquire. Coles is different. Coles will take time because it's been a poorly run company. But we're confident over the long term that the cash flows of the business will justify the investment. And the good news is that, you know, Wesfarmers is incredibly financially focused. I get monthly an update of how we're performing against our investment case. And the good news is that we're performing very much along the lines that we thought we would when we made the investment in late 2007. And that's because we take a conservative orientation into our assumptions. We ensure we put the right management in place. You do the right sort of things, and this works out. And part of it, ultimately, is to improve your return on equity, and I'm confident we'll do that.
I'll come back to another question on reputation just now, but my last question coming up, please put your thinking caps on. We've got some microphones either side of the room, so if you've got I think we've got room for a couple of questions. If you've got one burning away, I've got one more question, and then it's over to you. So, again, on the question of reputation, Richard, have we seen the last of the capital raisings for the foreseeable future? To come back at $13 a share after raising equity at $29 a share less than a year ago must have been heartbreaking. To go back again, that would be very damaging reputationally, surely, wouldn't it?
Well, Tom, it wasn't heartbreaking. It was a business decision. And what we did was we looked at the future and we looked at alternatives around asset sales, around managing capital and a whole bunch of things. But we looked at those in the most negative sense we could, which was, let's paint a scenario of the next few years where things are really, really grim. And then let's look at whether we get through that. And if that occurred, you know, we needed to make sure we had the balance sheet strength to deal with that. And we've now done it. The good news, at least, I think, is that on the last equity raising, those who invested in it have done reasonably well since then. And you know, I was one amongst many others who invested $29 not that long ago. But the world has changed considerably since then. Would we go again to shareholders? It is highly unlikely, but you never rule out these things. If a screamingly good acquisition came along and we felt we could manage it, in the very unlikely circumstances of that happening, you'd think about it. But I don't see any necessity to do any more capital raising because of the strength of our balance sheet. We raised $4.6 billion. We thought we'd raise about $3 billion. And we've retired half our debt. We've got very